Dr. Omar Morales, founder of Lyme Mexico Clinic. You are also a researcher, a board member of ILADS. Give us some information first about your background and then sort of build out how you became a medical doctor, how you founded the Lyme Mexico Clinic, and how your activism brought you, your research and your activism brought you to ILADS.
The short version or the long one?
Let's start with the short version because there's so much information that our folks are going to want to hear about treatment that we'll probably it's probably best to keep the background, I guess, on the shorter side.
I'll try on the short side. I was working in construction when my dad told me that if I did the test in university to get into medical school, that he would buy me a truck to continue doing my construction work. So he fooled me. I went in there. I did the test. I got a spot in the state university. And I was then starting my journey to the medical school. I never got the truck, though, so he definitely fooled me. It was a top hematologist. He always was in his top three in the country. So himself not only helped me develop as a man, but he also helped me develop medically as well in my career. And so by the time that I was coming out fresh out of medical school and I was working with him in the blood bank, we got a call from a patient, and the patient was having problems with his health. His blood was filled with infection. And so we said that we could do something for him. They decided to come down here and visit us. And together they brought a doctor who was actually an ILADS member. And we together devised a treatment, which was basically exchanging his infected blood for healthy blood. And that's how we started treating the first patient for what we know tick-borne diseases now. This is more than 10 years ago, about 10 years ago. And ever since, I was then completely amazed of this whole realm of diseases that normally go undermined and doctors really don't understand them. And I was now understanding something, and I knew something that other doctors didn't. So I felt that that was very special. I got to meet a lot of doctors who were almost movie stars on their own and in the Lyme community. And I was able to learn a little bit from all of them. And I even got my book, like a good nerd, and have them sign something on there. And I still have all those things. And as slowly I got interested more and more, and before I even knew, I was already very involved. And I was involved with ILADS. I am still very involved with ILADS, which is the standard of care and resource for patients and doctors internationally, worldwide, in regards to tick-borne disorders, not only Lyme, but anything that comes from that tick infection. So mast cell activation, encephalitis, PANS, PANDAS, Morgellons, the list goes on and on. And so it's been wild. It's a very unique experience, and I feel so blessed to be able to be part of it. I got involved in it in a very, I think, magical way. And as much as many of you guys, and I know some of your stories, and so the guys like us that are involved in this, we usually tend to be very involved and very personally involved. And I think that's what keeps me up going.
So I think it's a really, really powerful story where the spirits seem to take you in places where you were not ready to go. You wanted to swing a hammer or be involved in the construction trades, but the spirit brought you to medical school. You thought you were going to be working in a particular subset in the medical community, but the spirit brought you to the Lyme world, and then you go from patient zero to now being one of the leading researchers and one of the activists in the ILAD community. So talk about how this journey was one where you seem to be dragged from place to place, but your purpose became very clear to you when you found the tick-borne illness community.
So talk about something organic. I never did anything with any purpose of becoming something or building something. Things started piling up organically and led me in a such a gentle, organic way to where I'm right now. And honestly, I was a very shy guy, and I wasn't good at even speaking, to three people, let alone speaking in public to 500 doctors. And so my life has definitely turned upside down for the better. And I feel very part of this community with my patients. It's like we're a team. And I always tell my patients that, and I'm always open to collaborating with them, because they patients in this area, they're highly educated, so they will bring us some ideas. We learn through the patients a lot of the time, and so it's always necessary to give back to them as well, because that's how we exist. If patients had not gotten together in all of these different groups and made things as they are now, I would be working in a blood bank maybe, and maybe other doctors would be working in institutions where they wouldn't be maybe as interested or interesting for what they do right now. And so I started with a little office. I saw my first, after seeing my first patient, after doing that radical treatment, we only had one treatment then. It was changing the patient's blood from infected to healthy. That's the only thing we had, right? And so after that, I embarked into learning, and I went to Washington, Texas, Utah, Australia, Germany, and it never stopped. I always kind of knew, like, oh, okay, so I'm going to go this in December, and I'm going to go this in March. And then suddenly now, like, it's like I've been everywhere, and I'm still going to other places where I'm learning little techniques, little things. Like, once I learned how to put antiparasitics up to the brain, like things that I thought I would never use, and I actually did use them. And so these things, there's no specialty for Lyme disease. You make it your own somehow. And so during that course, from that one treatment that we had, I then grew to have under one roof, like all these, a fan of treatments. And then as I was doing them, I noticed that Lyme doesn't respond the same to everybody. So why is it? Well, because there are five different subtypes, and then there's about 300 different strains of Borrelia, and then there's co-infections, and then there's the genetics of the pathogen and the genetics of the patient. And so all of that plays a role. And so I ended up, from having all of these treatments, then just choosing, I need this and this and this for this case, and I need this, this, and that for this other case. And so I nowadays, I'm very specific to what I use. I am of the feeling that less is more, but there is a window time for treatment where you're more effective when treating Lyme, and when you're treating chronic infections. I don't believe in long-term treatment. I think that just the infection becomes resistant. So as a result, I grew from that little one office to a smaller. I was the first office I had was renting it in a hospital, which was great because I was able to have all the support I needed, and back then I didn't know how to handle that much Herxheimer's, and so the hospital would help me a little bit with that, but ultimately the hospital also never knows exactly how to deal with a Herxheimer. So I rented an office next door inside the hospital, which was available, thank God. And then all of a sudden in the waiting room, it was most of my patients, and then the hospital's patients were like left standing. And so as a result, I had to move out. And so I had my dad had his lab in a well-located medical district. And in the back of his lab, there was a parking lot. And so I got that lease from him, and I then after that built a whole building around that parking space to make it a Lyme center. And nowadays I have everything under one roof, and I like the Dr. Ligner when he says it's always good to have tools in the toolbox, and you have all these tools, and you'll use one or two, and then you won't use the others. But then when you have a I don't know, like a specific, a BMW or you know, a card that doesn't fit the same screwdriver, then you'll need a different tool. And that's what it's worth to have all these tools.
So let's talk about the medical system, and then we're going to talk about the definition of Lyme disease. But let's begin with the medical system. And one of the challenges that we've noted on this podcast on a regular basis is that when someone is suffering from an acute illness, that the medical system, at least here in the U.S., but I think internationally, works pretty well. But when somebody is suffering from a chronic illness, the system is not designed to treat that person or give that person what they need. And part of that is the chronically ill patient needs substantially more time than the acute care situation. So give us your perspective on the medical system in Mexico and the medical system internationally based on your research and your travels, and whether or not my observation to you that the system works well for acute illnesses, but not for chronic illnesses.
We, as medical students, we are never taught to treat, at least with any goal in mind, to cure a chronic infection. We're meant to give patients their pills, and we're meant to help them at least until recently. We had some breakthroughs with, like, for instance, with hepatitis, where now we're able to cure hepatitis, but it was known as a chronic condition as much as HIV, and we're just meant to only provide some kind of little treatment to help them in the process. And in turn, acute infections, we were taught to throw the kitchen sink at them, and with all the feeling that that was the way to go about it. But with chronic, we don't. And then we then graduate and then become specialized in our own areas. And then we even forget even further about chronic infections. And then if you have a chronic infection, you would say, okay, you go to the infectious disease doctor. But the reality is that Lyme, you asked me to give you a kind of a definition. I would be short to tell you what it is, because it's so broad, it's so complex, and it's multi-systemic. And at the same time, it could be localized, regional, and it, I think, varies on patient to patient.
And okay, so let me give you the Tick Food Camp definition of Lyme disease, and I'd like you to react to it. And because we think one of the things we've identified here is that Lyme disease is a disease without a definition. Right. And if you can't define a problem, how can you come up with a solution to a problem? So we decided here at Tick Boot Camp that we were going to take control of how we're going to define Lyme disease. Right. And our definition for Lyme disease is that it's a polymicrobial, multisystemic, chronic infectious disease. Give me a reaction to the definition that we're using when defining Lyme disease.
I think that I'm just going to say, generally speaking, any definition that you feel comfortable with, that's correct. But with the sense that it's never going to be able to involve everything that is going on, because it also creates issues, complex issues in the immune system and the central nervous system. And sometimes it's difficult to fit everything going on under one definition, especially if you want to try to keep it short. We had an exercise once in the Board of ILADS where we were putting together the definition for us, and there was 10 different physicians who are supposed to know the best and are supposed to be the best in their fields, and we all had kind of some agreement and disagreement about it. And at the end of the day, you have to be able to agree a little bit on the matter to define it. I think you're correct with the definition, but it somehow certain things I would say wouldn't be applied with that.
So I actually recently read the ILADS definition, which is about a page and a half long when you read the definition on the website. And what I thought was interesting was that I thought our definition actually hit on everything that you folks came up with yours, with just a more narrow set of elements, right? Because when you use the term polymicrobial, we are moving away from the CDC definition, which is it's a disease, an infectious disease caused by one bacteria, right? One strain of bacteria. When we use the term multisystemic, it is taking into account all of the different systems of the human body. And when we define it as a chronic illness, we're moving away from this acute illness, which is a very, very different, experience. So I did carefully look at the definition that you folks came up with at ILADS. I like it. But I think from a patient perspective, it is so long and it is so comprehensive that it almost even loses its capacity to help us understand what it is that we're suffering from. So I still like our definition, even though you may want to part company with it.
I'm not saying I don't like. I actually love it, and I'm not saying I love the ILADS one either. And that's why I try to not define it. Because it's for me, it's impossible.
Well, yeah. So, you know, Dr. McDonald, when we interviewed him one or two or three times, we love Dr. McDonald. I know you've quoted him in a recent video I watched of yours, and his position is we should divorce from Lyme. We shouldn't use the term. It's impossible. It's impossible to really come up with a definition for this disease complex. So his argument is, and he's actually written an article on this for LymeDisease.org. His position is we should divorce from the term. Do you fall more in his camp, where you think we should really be divorcing from the term, or do you think it's a term that has virtue?
My feeling is that Lyme is powerful, is a powerful word, and that moving away from it, would not be useful for the patients, because it's very powerful, and I believe we should continue using it. But I understand where Dr. McDonald is coming from, in the sense that it's no longer Lyme. It's a number of complex, multisystemic and issues that are affecting many patients in different forms. And I guess the more that we try to categorize it, I think that it will, in a certain filing or small square where we're able to put that in there, I think that the more we're trying to make it fit in there, I think that we're the more that we're going to lose, I think, strength on what it's accomplished right so far.
But Dr. Morales, there is the other side of this, right? And the other side of this is, if we don't have a term and we don't have a definition, then what we're doing is we're playing into the hands of folks who argue there's no such thing as Lyme disease, right? Which, of course, is then going to further isolate patients who are suffering from this disease. So one of the reasons I like to spend a lot of time, especially with thoughtful people like you, in having the conversation about Lyme disease, is because if we get too far away from having a term and a definition, then we're going to fall victim to, and there are organizations, you know who they are, that are taking the position that that there is no such thing as Lyme disease.
Yeah, well, it's just that Lyme disease can be chronic and be acute as well, and we should consider that. And then we need to make sure that we also understand that Lyme is just a catch-all phrase for this number of varied other problems that come when there's a tick bite, because when there's a tick bite, as the tick is engulfing your blood or the patient's blood, it's also passing through its gut a lot of pathogens and immune-suppressive factors. So it's, of course, Lyme disease, it is a catch-all phrase, and it could not completely give us the information we need to be able to diagnose patients. So we have to be very careful as healthcare practitioners into how are we going to be diagnosing these cases. So I try to be as specific as I can when I'm doing so, because that's a medicine based on evidence, and we should always strive to try to be as evidence-based as possible. So I would try to do acute or chronic Lyme, with signs of neurological involvement, with infections that are coexisting, such as And so I don't just say this patient has Lyme and or chronic Lyme or acute Lyme. It depends on the type of patient. So I do believe that that's best to have all the proper vocabulary available so that we can individualize diagnosis.
Okay, and we can also agree to disagree about whether or not Lyme disease is something that's acute or chronic. You know, because I think an early stage presentation is very, very different than a chronic disease. And I think the merging of both the chronic and acute and the acute and the chronic presentation also creates some problems, I think, from a definitional standpoint. But I do want to follow up on one more thing before Matt starts to join us, and that is you put up some really, really powerful videos of lectures that you've given on your website. By the way, your website is beautiful. It's really, really well done. And the information that you have presented is very, very well presented, and it's understandable for at least this layperson. I really appreciate the work you've done there. And one of the talks you had given that's I know up on YouTube, but it's also embedded in your website, was a talk you had given at ILADS about a tick bite and the presentation of Lyme disease from a tick bite versus the presentation of Lyme disease if it's either sexually transmitted or it is congenitally transmitted. And I actually want to address a third one that you didn't address in that interview, which is I thought was interesting, knowing your background and having worked in the blood bank. You didn't bring up the third one that we bring up here at Tick Boot Camp. So here at Tick Boot Camp, we talk about the upstream and the downstream vehicles for Lyme disease. And upstream, we define that as a tick bite, right? And we are Tick Boot Camp, right? And there's a reason why we're Tick Boot Camp, right? But downstream, you did recognize in your lecture that that Lyme disease can be transmitted sexually. It can be transmitted congenitally. And we here at Tick Boot Camp talk about a third transmission, which is through a blood transfusion. So talk to us a little bit here about the difference between a tick bite transmission versus sexual, congenital, or blood transfusion, and why a tick bite is more likely to result in a chronic presentation than the other three types of transmission.
When I started having patients who their significant other was requesting us to get him or her tested, and we tested them, and they both showed a positive test result, but only one of them showed symptoms, I came to my personal conclusion that it was because it had a different circumstance on how they got infected, in the sense that because the infection, when it's transmitted through a tick bite, it enters with force. It enters in a very violent manner because the tick is attached to the blood vessel, injecting blood thinners so that it can engulf blood without it causing a blood clot. As a result, the guts of the tick gets in touch with the mouth and the harpoon that is attached to the blood vessel of that host. During that process, many infections are going to be passed into the bloodstream of that individual. At that same time, the protein SALP2 and I believe SALP10 from the tick are also excreted from the saliva of the tick into the bloodstream of the patient. That protein makes itself all the way down to the bone marrow of the host, of the human host, and it suppresses the monocyte-derived dendritic cells, which are the most important antigen-presenting cells of the innate system, which are basically going to cause an important immune suppressive effect with acute and long-standing functions, and hence why the infection so violently dissipates into the central nervous system, into the joints, into the bone. Sometimes we've cultured bone marrow from patients and it has Lyme disease. So
let's pause there for a second. I do want to invite our listeners to go to your website and look at the third video, and at about the 14-minute mark, the graphic that you presented and the very detailed description you've given is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's really, really well done. And I certainly want to invite people to listen to and watch that entire video. But let me break a couple of pieces down for you and ask you to react to it. So the first thing that we understand is that when a tick is biting you, right, it is going through your flesh, and it is ultimately putting its mouthpiece into your bloodstream, right? And in order to be able to get through your flesh without you feeling it, the tick spit is going to have some proteins that are going to prevent you from having either a pain response or an itch response. So first talk about that first piece, which is unique to a tick, where it's biting you and you can't feel it and you don't have an itch response while it's attached to you.
It inhibits pathways of inflammation as it's injecting its harpoon so that you don't feel it. There is no reaction from your skin. There is an anesthetic effect. And at that same time, other proteins are going to be involved in immune suppression and in blood thinning. So there are, if you want to say, look at it, three different situations going on that make this the perfect invader.
Okay, so we have this, we also have a tick that has a mouthpiece that is very jagged, right? So while it's going through the skin, there are then parts of the mouthpiece which make it so that it's difficult to pull out of the skin. And it also has a cement that it excretes, which actually cements its mouthpiece into your skin. So talk about how not only is it preventing us from having an initial immune response, which would be pain, and an itch response and inflammation, but it's also now by the very design of its mouthpiece stuck in the skin, in part because of the mouthpiece and in part because of the cement that it spits out, where it cements itself into the skin, where it will not fall out now if you're moving around.
Ticks are physiologically manufactured to stick. They know where to stand and they know how to stick when you're passing through those branches of leaves and trees, and they know at what height they're going to capture more animals. So there is something in their own genome that it inherently produces an effect of attachment to its host. And that goes from the very external part of where it stands on a leaf to how it grabs on you, to how it feeds on you, to the bottom molecular pieces that will create proteins that will not only serve as attachments to your own natural resources, but physical attachment with its own teeth that are in there, embedded in those harpoons, that will be physically grabbing those cellular matrices that are in around the blood vessel. And if you are pulling on a tick and the tick is feeding, most likely you will leave the head in there. So one of the resources I'm pretty sure most of the people hearing you will know is, or I don't know if they will, but you can inject saline just below where they're biting so that with the pressure, they will still be attached, but they will no longer be able to take blood. That way you reduce the rate of infection. And the tick, if it's not engulfing, it's going to let go. And all the proteins that it has that are attaching it to the matrix are going to be also dissipating immediately. So when you have a tick and you feel like you're going to take the head out, instead of unscrewing it, I think it's best to inject it. If you have a little needle, subcutaneous injection helps.
Yes, let me challenge you on that, because I know you made that argument in your video, and my concern about that is, well, let me ask you first. If we do pull the tick off and the mouthpiece is left in, let's say for example, my last tick bite, the tick was biting me on my leg. I did pull it out and I was able to get the mouthpiece out because I was able to use a very fine set of tweezers that got so close to my skin, I was able to pull the whole mouthpiece out. So you can do that if you properly remove the tick. But let's say the worst case scenario is I pull the tick off and the mouthpiece is still stuck in my leg. what's the big deal? I mean, because really what the disease process is from the tick spitting into us, not just the split, not just the blood, but also the microbes in the tick gut. Is it really a big deal if the mouthpiece is left in me? No. And can I go to get that removed by a dermatologist, for example?
So here's when the infection becomes difficult to be placed on a certain category, especially for definition. I see patients who have gotten tick bites on the left arm. As a result, that left arm is rendered useless years after. How do you put that in the definition? How do you account for those typical presentations? How do you treat those and how do you prevent those? And the patients that I've seen who have had that kind of disability happen usually are patients that tell me that they left some part of the tick in there, or that they couldn't pull the whole thing out. Eventually, your body is going to destroy that down to the last element of it. But it's the way that your body responds to it, which I believe creates a regional problem. And I talk about also something known as metabolic response to trauma, which is a whole chapter in the book of surgery, where patients who undergo surgical procedures or injuries, their metabolic systems, they go so haywire that things will be awoken. It's like a little bit, I'm going to deviate a little bit from this topic, again, from the tick bite to the metabolic response to trauma, now to COVID, because also COVID produces something similar, where there is a metabolic response to infection, which as a result triggers dormant viruses to awake, endogenous viruses to come up and now produce symptoms and inflammation. And there's no longer the COVID, it's now endogenous viruses that were, there are even in some cases wild viruses that are there that are now triggering inflammation. So why is it important to remove the head or remove the, as many particles of that? It's not mainly because of the infection that they could have in the head. There's no more infection in the head than there is in the stomach.
Well, there's less, so, right? I mean, once the stomach is not pumping into the head, there's no infection, right?
So the only thing that is worth, why is worth removing those pieces is because of the metabolic response to the occupation of that area, which will eventually be used as a resistance point, as a cocoon. It will be reshaped and remodeled to something that we cannot control. And that even 10 years later in the future, the patient will complain of that place. And some patients will say, oh, I have things coming out of that place all the time under for the last 4 or 5 years. And even we've cut pieces of tissue. I think I'm enjoying this podcast more because I like the challenge. And I like that you're challenging in that regard. And I like challenges from my patients too, when they say, I have things coming out of my skin that I can't understand. And I believe that they're this other thing. Hey, I'm not anybody to say otherwise. Give me that piece and I'll put it in a microscope. And we put it in a microscope and we find certain patterns and we find certain things. Every time we've studied these tissues, we find inflammation and we find spirochetes. So what is the head? Nothing, but it localizes a problem.
So I'm with you. And one of the mistakes that I can tell you I made and my family made culturally when I was young and I was getting bitten by ticks, is we thought you remove the tick and you're good, right? We didn't participate in any wound care. We didn't participate in any prophylactic treatments. We didn't do anything. Thank God I never got sick, but I was bitten by ticks scores and scores of times during my life. And we just pulled it off and that was the end of it, right? So wound care is certainly an important element of dealing with a tick bite. But where the reason I'm challenging you is because the likelihood of someone having a having a syringe locally where they can now go and get saline and put that under their skin before they pull it off is very unlikely, right? And as a practical matter, what I'm most concerned about when I'm coaching folks on how to deal with a tick bite is getting that tick off as quickly as possible, right? Because I did make the mistake one time when I was in college. I was bitten by a tick when I had come home from school, and I didn't remove it right away. I went to the doctor's office. I had to call, I had to make an appointment. I had to wait till I got to the doctor. The doctor then had to see me, then he had to take it off. And over all that period of time, which is probably somewhere between an hour and 2 hours, that tick was spitting more, you know, microbes into my system. So when given the choice between, you know, the perfect solution versus the practical solution,
let me rephrase then my recommendation to, if you have a needle around you in the first 30 minutes, you inject it with saline, and then the infection will be probably more easier to treat in the future.
Let me challenge you on that. Even 30 minutes, right? I mean, there are some microbes that could cause you to become chronically ill, maybe even die as quickly as 15 minutes, right? I mean, Powassan, for example, or Powassan, however you pronounce that disease, could cause you to suffer a viral infection and ultimately cause you to die within 15 minutes of a tick bite. If I waited 30 minutes to now put saline under my, you know, under the skin before I remove that tick, I might find myself in a position that I wouldn't otherwise be in. So give me your reaction to even a 30-minute delay in pulling that tick off.
I think most people have it more than 30 minutes, and if you look at statistics. And the goal here is to be able to have more resources. I think that the best case scenario would still be to try and remove it that way. And I don't know if I would go as far as removing it any other method if I had it on my skin within that time frame. Is that if I have nothing to use, I will use my nails to get it out. After that, I would most likely make sure to just go in there, have a doctor take a look at it with something that magnifies, and then take whatever else is in there. I wouldn't leave anything in there.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. I mean, and wound care is a very important piece of this. So let's build out the next element of your presentation on your website, which is now we have this, I mean, this machine, this machine that is designed to find you, grab you, bite you, now spit in you. And what's happening now is there's this exchange between the blood that's being sucked out of you and the spit and microbes are being spit into you, and the blood that's being sucked out of you. And when the blood is being sucked out of you, there are now proteins in your blood that are now being exchanged in your gut with the microbes in the tick's gut, which are now being spit into you. And we have the immunosuppressive elements of the tick spit itself. And we now have microbes that are being spit into us that in part have proteins from our blood, which may also make them more difficult for our immune system responses. So give us the outline of those two pieces.
The immune system gets affected by the tick saliva, I would say probably more than the tick itself, but the tick saliva is only a process that can go through 15 to 30 minutes in some cases, or in some cases for hours or days. So that process eventually happens, and then it goes more into the back seat. The immune system has an immune suppressive effect that can lead up to 3 months after that, because that's about the enough necessary amount of time for the immune system to be rebuilding new cells. But then later in life, the spirochete itself has other proteins in the surface, and I talk about that as well, which produces immunological inhibition to cluster differentiation cells and IgG antibody production. So effectively causes a primary immune deficiency. And then there is the depletion of resources, which is a secondary effect of immune suppression, because it's a chronic bacteria. And then it's just sending all of its resources out. So eventually that also produces another immunological effect. At the end of the day, so you're going to be able to find different immunological problems depending on the stage. And so you can't really say all of these are going to happen, but they may happen depending on the stage where the patient is at. I think the one that I'm interested the most, because research shows that patients that have the higher level of antigen presenting cells have the highest chances of remission. this is a study. That's effectively how it's presented. Patients with the higher numbers of dendritic cell antigen-presenting cells are directly proportionate to patients feeling less symptomatic. So why is it that that's happening? And the reason is because antigen-presenting cells in their development, they are produced in the skin and in the bone marrow. So they have different, slightly different, it's like a key going inside a keyhole. They have slightly different combinations, these two. And the one that produces the most effect, that has the highest efficacy rate is in Lyme disease, monocyte-derived dendritic cells, more so than skin dendritic cells. So what we see is that in the early stage, monocyte-derived dendritic cells are suppressed in Lyme. And in a chronic stage, most likely both will be suppressed, but majorly dendritic cells that are located near to the skin. They're not suppressed. They're there. They're immature. So I like the fact that we can, to a certain degree, re-educate the immune system by just allowing those dendritic cells to become mature. This is a separate topic and something that we've been working on. And this is basically technology that I learned from my father as he was using it for cancer patients back in early 2000s and the 90s. And we just readapted that technology to make it work for bacteria. But to your question and to your earlier question, how is it that patients become sick when they're exposed to Borrelia through a tick bite and they don't get sick when they get exposed through sexual intercourse or even other forms like breast milk or blood? Because the immune system is not suppressed in all those stages. The immune system, when it's active and it gets exposed to the bacteria, like in sexual intercourse, which I see often, there is a strong immunological presence and there is not a violent immune suppression. So the bacteria comes in, the immune system, boom, it clashes over and over on a wall of immunity. As a result, that patient kind of gets immunized. So I tell my patients, hey, don't worry about it. If your husband has it right now, it seems that it's not causing any symptoms. He's probably immunized. And of course, you want to think about those patients who are not in that scenario, which are having issues and they're going to just pass it back to their significant other. So you have to be careful with that. So that doesn't apply for everybody.
Right. So one of the things that we confronted yesterday in a podcast that I did with a young woman who was actually afraid to date and afraid to be in intimate relationships with other people because she was afraid that she'd infect someone else if she kissed them. She was afraid that she would infect someone else if she was sexually active and intimate with another person. And we had a pretty long conversation about just being wise and engaging in safe practices. Of course, have a conversation with your partner and let your partner know that you're infected. But there are a number of different safe practices that you can engage in so that you don't have to be concerned about infecting someone else. So can you talk a little bit about what safe practices someone who is infected could utilize so that they do not have to be concerned about having an intimate relationship with another person?
So I'm going to involve a little bit more Jelens here because I think it's also a topic that's also questioned a lot in that regard. Kissing and touching will have no effect that we know about that could be transmissible. Being involved in oral sex and being involved in sexual intercourse does have the possibility of being of passing infection to someone if you are, number one, if you're not in remission. Because if you're in remission, you have zero chance of passing it. And I'll talk about what remission is. But going back to a little bit the Morgellons, because I got asked this, can someone with Morgellons be touching people? And I know this is not the topic that we're supposed to talk about. I just want to make sure I talk about it right now because I get asked about this. you get in touch with a Morgellons patient, I always say hi and give them my hand, and it's fine. You're not going to get infected by those fibers because they're keratin and macrophages and maybe Borrelia. However, and if you have, let's say if you eat your nails and your nails are as a result bleeding or have bled or are an area of entry for pathogen, and you go and touch someone with Morgellons, you can get Morgellons. And the same goes for a number of infections. And if the patient has Lyme in the surface of the skin, which is honestly rare, unless the patient is having skin scabs, which are popping up with blood, then you would have Lyme in the skin. And then kissing, the saliva doesn't allow many pathogens to live in there. And we have a lot of immunological doorways here, which are keeping pathogens in check. The same goes for the rectum. And so usually it wouldn't allow us to all knowledge, impossible to get Lyme from a kiss. Can you get it through, oral sex or rimming or sexual intercourse? Yes.
Okay. And what safe practices would you recommend to folks who have Lyme disease so that they would not pass it on to a partner?
So again, this is all theoretical because there isn't research on it that I have read. Please correct me if there is. I'm happy to look into it. The method would be, in my opinion, because I believe that a healthy sexual life is something that everybody has a right to have. I think it would be wise to be using protection in the sense of treatment. So some cases who are asymptomatic, if they have the fear that they're going to pass the infection and they want to use and they don't want to use a condom, they can take a disulfiram. They can take a group of antibiotics. That would be enough protection for them to avoid from passing that to someone else, theoretically speaking. Of course, I can't be sure because there is no study about it. But if the infection goes into hiding and goes into biofilm whenever you're treating it, then that should tell you that when you're having sex, you should be fine. Of course, having to use a condom is always the safest matter.
Okay, very good. So before Matt joins us, I'd like to now...
You said that three times already, Rich.
Change the frame of the conversation. Well, I'm enjoying this conversation so much, I don't want to let Matt in, because I know once Matt starts talking, Rich is going to now be on silence. So the next thing we'd like to do to reframe the conversation is now talk about someone who presents with Lyme disease and what the process you use for preparing them for treatment, what treatment you would use, what recommendations you have for rehabilitation, and what recommendations you have for helping them to maintain remission after they've ultimately succeeded in achieving remission.
I ask questions. That's my favorite part of my work. Asking questions is the way I understand my patients. And one day I just decided to write down the method of how I was going to ask the questions many years ago. And I have stuck to that questioning, not the question themselves, but the question patterns. And so there is a detective work involved when it comes to Lyme. Again, Lyme being the catch-all phrase for everything. I'm not talking about Borrelia in particular, but everything related to Lyme, including Borrelia. And so sometimes I will have patients who have gotten decent treatment, really good treatment. So why should, how could I make any different? And if they haven't gotten better, right? This is something that I get often. Hey, I've done already hyperthermia and I have already done, IVIG and a number of things that I would normally say, hey, this is good treatment. And I'm still sick. And so to me, it's very important that detective work in that moment with the questions, because if you haven't gotten better with what I would consider the standard for the best treatment, is because something has been missed out. And so that leads me to another set of questions. Are you having environmental exposures? Are you having issues with your gums? Are you having root canals? Are those root canals producing cavitations? Is the jawbone infected? Is there osteomyelitis? If there's osteomyelitis, then that is one source. If the patient is having other conditions, and the list goes on from epstein, like I see patients with PANS, they don't get better. And I'm like, well, have we looked into HHV6, HHV7, Epstein-Barr? If they're having an autoimmune encephalitis bit because of viral infections and not from bacteria. So all of these things matter. And that goes down to things that are very just sometimes simple, like, oh, I have, a prosthetic breast implants or prosthetic pieces or patients with surgery that have screws that are infected, things like that, that sometimes I will have to lead them to a surgical room sometimes in order for them to get over that encapsulated part of the infection. So once that I am able to determine what is going on, I'm able to put down a plan for them. If the patient is not of that sort where they haven't done what I would consider to be the best treatment, those patients then I would analyze and assess on their symptoms, on their problems, on their lab reports. I don't focus on one thing, and I never get married with one diagnosis. If the patient says Lyme, and I look at it and I'm like, nope, doesn't seem like it's Lyme. And I know my office's name is Lyme Mexico. It's one word. I like it like that, Lyme Mexico. And I honestly, there are days that I see zero patients of Lyme, and I have a full agenda of all other things that are unrelated or sometimes related to Lyme. And so we do see neurodegeneration, inflammatory neuropathies, demyelination, and other things that sometimes will also need attention. And so patients will say, well, why do I still feel sick? Well, lacking illness is one part, but being in good shape is another. So this has led me to do a lot of regenerative treatment and a lot of things to address neurodegeneration. And I did a scientific review of 689 neurological Lyme disease cases, which I'm actually presenting this work and the upcoming conference in Munich in April, where I'm going to be presenting those results. The idea is that as we're assessing these cases, I like to make my key in my practice is something that I got, that I learned early. As I said, I had great teachers. My dad was a great teacher, and I learned to do a problem list. So my problem list will be in order of priority. And I always like to put my priorities depending on the day as I'm seeing them. So if I see you the first time, and I'm going to put up there Bartonella, Babesia, Lyme, and maybe immune suppression, and maybe even biofilm, and maybe even mold, and blah, 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 blah. But then I see you for a second time, the problem has changed because we gave you treatment. So now on my list, now the problem is Epstein-Barr, autoimmune encephalitis, and now Lyme. So the first three usually are the ones that capture most of my attention. And then the third time and fourth time, it switches and switches. And then the problem list starts getting shorter. By the time we're done with treatment, after I have addressed everything that I need to address, because I'm not changing the oil and balls wagon. This is a human being, and we're looking at a patient as a whole. So if the patient is having other problems besides Lyme, I'm going to also make sure that those get addressed. Dental problems, other issues with other problems. Like I said, sometimes I have to lead them into surgery, and I have to contact ophthalmologists. I have to contact the cardiologist. We have had patients that are this close to dying before starting treatment because they have a complete heart blockage. And I'm like, hey, hold on a minute. This looks like you have a problem in the heart. Hey, cardiologist, do me a favor, check him out before we get started. You know what? This patient has a 95% artery blocked. So these kind of things we have to do as well, because we're not mechanics here. And so as we're doing that process, then I usually try to manage four things, generally speaking: treat the active infection, make sure the persistent part like biofilms gets treated and eradicated. Without biofilms, this infection gets in remission. With biofilms, this infection comes back. Make sure the immune system is treated properly. If it's dendritic cells, immunoglobulins, GCMAF, or any transfer factor, or any other treatment, for that matter, immune modulating too. So if it's too overreactive, bring it down. If it's too low, bring it up. And then fourth, detox. We probably do more detox than any other treatment. It's like, I give this example often. It's like if you're in your home and you're trying to get to the hospital, but it snowed all day and all night, and you can't get there because there's snow. How do you get there? Well, the only way to be able to get you to feel better is to detoxify you. And we have to blow through that snow of toxins. So if we do detox, the pathway is open for you to get treated. If I don't do detox, then I come to one problem. Either I treat you with intense treatment, but then your homeostasis collapses. So that's why you shouldn't just throw the kitchen sink at patients when you're treating them, because even though it's your best, you know, it's in your best, how do you say this?
Your best interest?
But yeah, like you want to do something good for the patient, right? And as a doctor, you're like forced with that decision. Okay, what treatment do I give him? I want to give him the treatment that actually changes the outcome. So I'm going to give him a very intense treatment because that's what I think is best. But if the homeostasis of the patient is not fit for that, and then instead of the infection rate coming down, you're going to see the homeostasis and the cellular function and cellular communication come down. So that's why you have to also select the treatment as you're going to start it, because not everybody is able to receive an intense approach. Generally speaking, I prefer always intravenous treatment than the oral approach, because the oral approach will not be sufficiently effective in penetrating tissues with reduced blood flow, which is why I do a lot of treatments to stimulate blood flow. And as I'm stimulating blood flow, I'm doing a lot of detox to bring out toxins, which are also lodged in places that have reduced blood flow. And that is that is the gist of it.
So Dr. Morales, I have a few follow-up questions on what you just outlined there, because the four steps that you generally use as a rule of thumb are: treat the infection, identify persistent infections that you have to treat like biofilms, otherwise you will become chronic and it'll keep, you know, coming back up and rearing its ugly head. You want to focus on the immune system, and some people may have a weakened immune system or an overactive immune system. We need to identify which bucket they fall in and then address them accordingly, and then detox. But is that sequential? Meaning, is that something you do in order? Because like in my case, I feel that I did myself a disservice by not detoxing properly before doing aggressive IV treatment. So, you know, I'm just curious, is this just a bucket of things, or is this an order that you recommend as well?
It is based on individual cases, because as I said, it goes in with the clinical presentation of that case. Someone that has already compromised his or her homeostasis, you can't do anything than detox. Until you bring that homeostasis level to somewhere where you can treat it, then you treat it. The right. First case I treated was completely parasitic and filled with infection. If I had given him one more antibiotic, that patient would have blown one kidney, because he was having hemolysis, that the hemolysis was destroying his kidneys. So one more antibiotic, more hemolysis, that kidney would have shut down on us.
Right.
So what we did a form of detox, because we grabbed his infected blood, we discarded it, and we exchanged it for healthy blood. As a result, the infection rate came down. That's not really a detox treatment, but it's a means of eliminating toxins and infection. And Rich asked me, how does it happen when you're treating a patient, and what happens after, and how do you keep him better? The first, the method that I use is the first phase of treatment in a patient I can have them in a good homeostasis level is give them enough intensity of treatment in a certain window of time to reduce the infection rate. As I'm doing that, obviously detox, as I mentioned, and immune modulation, and and eradication of biofilm. I'm going to be repetitive because it's important to be thorough. And the important part is the immune system. It takes 3 months for that immune system to be able to put a lid on a problem so that you can get that patient off of treatment and that problem doesn't just bounce back, which is what happens with a lot of patients. So after I treat them here intensely for a number of weeks, in the best case scenario, 4 weeks, in the worst case scenario, 8 weeks, I try to not go past the 10-week mark because then what am I doing? I'm bringing down the homeostasis again so much that then it's counterproductive. So it has a lot to do with that problem, that the way that we're treating patients. And once I treat them that way, and we finalize that part of the treatment, the intense part, I discharge them. I send them home. I partially discharge them because I keep doing consults over the phone with them for the next months to come. And I give them a follow-up plan for that, for those 3 months that follow until their immune systems are in good shape. And those 3 months that follow usually involve supplements, peptides, antibiotics, injected antibiotics, some cases detox that is injected as well. And we will provide them with all of that so they take home and they can continue with their part of treatment. And that's the way that we're able to kind of hold on until the hurricane passes, and then they can come out into the fields in a sense where their immune system is now ready for them to stop the treatment and be able to take care of them. And we measure that. And so I talk about remission. That is the goal. That's always the goal. Can we achieve remission with everybody? No, I don't think so. I think we achieve remission with the majority of cases eventually. And at least that's what I see with patients I'm talking to, especially patients I haven't talked to in a long time. And the way we do that is by treating the infection intensely, following up until the immune system is ready, and then afterwards checking 3 things. The immune cells are ready. The CD57, CD56 are in good shape. The immunoglobulins are being produced. IgG1, IgG3 are not immune suppressed anymore. And this means the infection is no longer causing immune suppression. 3, all tick-borne related pathogens are in negative testing reports. There's nothing coming back positive. I said 3, and really the CD57 and IgG turn is immune system, that's one. And then the last is clinical improvement. The patient should have less symptoms or no symptoms. And then in that moment, that patient is in remission. Can some patient be in remission from Lyme and still be sick? Yes. Those patients that have neurological damage, that have structural damage, that have a issue with their myelin sheath, those patients will still have problems, and they will now need a different form of treatment in addition to the Lyme treatment.
All right, so let me ask a quick follow-up there, Dr. Morales, because one of the concepts we've heard a lot about are biofilms. And Dr. McDonald is, you know, a big researcher in that area. He's talked to us in great detail about his research. But then we've had other researchers on who cite that biofilms simply don't exist with Lyme disease, that they've studied biofilms. Maybe they find Babesia in biofilm colonies, but they've never been able to see Lyme in a biofilm. So, you know, for example, Dr. Monica Ember cited on her podcast publicly that she hasn't been able to ever see it or prove it herself. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that, about there being a debate still potentially over Lyme's involvement in biofilms and forming these colonies which are more resistant to treatment?
I haven't seen Borrelia in a biofilm because I'm not a scientist. Scientists and physicians, the moment we start collaborating, the moment that we are able to be able to use the science and the practice at the same time is when we are actually able to produce a best outcome. And so clinically speaking, I see the biofilms, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
In a patient where I'm treating in a certain way, like if I'm indiscriminate in the way I'm giving that patient treatment, that patient continues to be sick. It's like a window time. So I see treatment sometimes that is nonstop. Boom, 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 the same antibiotic, 4 months. They stop the antibiotic, the disease is still there. The disease comes back. But then I see pulse treatments, okay? And then when there's pulse treatments, it kind of seems like the infection is no longer just hiding in some reservoir. It's coming out at certain points. And as it's coming out, because of that pulse manner, the infection gets treated differently. So that has a tendency to have a better outcome. So clinically speaking, there are reservoirs. Some say it's biofilm. Some say it's round bodies. Some say it's in cyst forms, persisting cells. You can call it, you know, I accept the term biofilm because it's the most scientifically accurate term. And the good thing about research is you'll always have researchers differ with their points of view, and that's valid. The same goes for clinicians. We will differ in our points of view. Nobody has the full truth. And I believe that this is true because a lot of the studies that are being done are with animals, and very few studies are being done with human organs. So you cannot really extrapolate the same result that one research is providing to another in terms of duplicating results, because sometimes they're just doing their research in different manners. So that explains also the way that some researchers will confirm biofilms and some researchers will differ from that.
But can't guys also be just a question of defining the term Lyme, right? Because I think if Matt were going to revisit that question, he might use the word Borrelia and argue that Dr. Embers hasn't found biofilm and Borrelia, as opposed to this other set of microbes that are a part of this polymicrobial disease, right? And I think both Dr. McDonald and Dr. Embers could be correct. It's just that we're not defining the microbes as narrowly as we should. And because some people are defining Lyme disease as a polymicrobial infection, well, yeah, we're going to see biofilm as an issue, and it needs to be treated because it is polymicrobial, as opposed to just identifying on the CDC definition and that one bacteria where we're not seeing the same biofilm. So I think they're both right. I think it goes back to the debate we were having earlier, Dr. Morales, which is what's the definition of Lyme disease?
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I have the fortune of being more clinician than scientist, because I'm able to be good with the clinical improvement without having to prove the research theory. But I believe that in order for us to be able to fix this in this generation, I like to quote sometimes, and I always get the quotes wrong because I'm very ADHD, but Max Planck at some point said that in order to find the truth of some situation, we would have to see that generation get over, and then the new generation will know that the truth is precisely that, the one that was being fought for. And so I'm hoping that we're going to be able to solve the Lyme situation in this generation and not have to be able to pass it to our children. And so in order for that to happen, we have to go hand in hand, clinicians and researchers. That's how we speed up this process.
Agreed. And I think putting egos aside, which you are a very humble doctor, Dr. Morales, is a really important item here. And, you know, we've had a variety of researchers on, some of whom have been humble like you, some of whom not so much, right? And I think that's maybe a potential problem there, but that's a whole side conversation. So let's talk about the immune system component, right? Because the immune system component of this is really important. And what always has fascinated me about Lyme disease, right, however we define that, is some people, their immune systems are completely non-functional, barely functioning, and they need immune boosters and they need support. Other people have overactive immune systems, this autoimmune component, where they need modulators to kind of balance it out and take it out of that, you know, as other doctors have called it, the cell danger response mode, right? So why does Lyme present differently in different people regarding the immune system, in some cases where the immune system is barely functioning and in other cases where the immune system is overfunctioning?
So I think that a lot has to do, and not only for the immune system, but with the illness. But it comes down to a thing that we're not able to manipulate yet, which is genetics. And some people will have a predisposition for autoimmunity. Some people will have a predisposition for immune suppression. And during illness, some pathogens are more immune suppressive than others. Like, for instance, and this is just from a clinical standpoint, I'm going to say Borrelia is more immune suppressive than Bartonella. Bartonella is more auto-inflammatory and more autoimmune than Borrelia. And I see this, for instance, with Bartonella, that a lot of the patients I see have an elevated anti-nuclear antibody mark that is from anywhere from 0.8, from 1 over 80 to 1 over 300. And if the patient had actual lupus, it would be usually 1 over 1,000. But when it comes to Lyme disease, I don't see that much. I see more CD57 is low, leukopenia, neutropenia, and low production of antibodies. So the infection also plays a role with the immune response. And I would say maybe 50-50, the infection versus the genetics of that, of the predisposing genetics of that individual.
Right. So if you're bitten by a tick and you get Bartonella and Borrelia, which is possible, depending on your genetics, if you're predisposed to autoimmunity or being immune suppressed, the Borrelia can make you more immune suppressed and the Bartonella can make you more autoimmune driven, depending on your genetic predisposition. So in both cases, that's why we have two different outcomes, potentially different pathogens and different genetics, you're saying, right?
And that is really the whole problem with the definition of this disease, because the definition is a problem, as Rich was pointing out. But the bigger problem comes after, once you define it, how do you treat it? How do you treat something that has so many variables and in the presentation? And then there are some things that apply for most, but there isn't one size fits all treatment. Even the approach that I take, if my friends who know very limited information about this, my friends, they seen how I do things, and they tell me, oh, don't be stupid. You should patent your work so that nobody can copy and you can be the top doctor in the world. I'm like, doesn't work like that, because number one, I'm not looking to patent anything, but really the reality is that patients don't respond good the same to the same treatment. And it's because there is genetically speaking variability. And so how do you then propose, after the definition is even accepted worldwide, how do you then propose the best management? That's the hard part.
Yeah, so the other thing I want to jump into with you, Dr. Morales, is you touched on that this spring you're going to be presenting at ILADS in Germany about the neurodegenerative parts of Lyme disease. And, you know, that's a really important part. We just had somebody reach out this week telling us they've been treated with Lyme disease. They had a seizure disorder. They were in remission. They had a relapse, and now they're having seizures again, and they're not sure what to do. And should they go back on IV antibiotics? What are the options there? But unfortunately, this neurodegenerative component is really important, and there's a lot of conflict whether neurological Lyme is real, whether it can be cured, whether there's permanent damage. So can you just touch on, you basically read all the research studies pertaining to neural Lyme, and you've done all this work leading up to the conference. Can you give us a teaser about what you're going to share and what your findings have been?
And always comes down to my opinion, is that there will be a number of patients, but I'm going to focus on two. There will be the patient who has Lyme disease with neurological implications. And then there's the patient who has neurological Lyme. You see what I'm saying? There are differences from one another. The first will have a Lyme diagnosis. So systemically, they have Lyme. But in the brain, there are a lot of neurological symptoms, but not as a result of the Lyme, but of the aftermath of the Lyme and of the immunological reaction of the brain as a result of Lyme having been there. And also very important, of the leakage of the blood-brain barrier. Because the immune system systemically is dumber than the neuroimmune system. And so if you have Lyme and it crosses into the brain because it's very smart, and that triggers the microglia to shoot a lot of inflammatory cells in the brain, then that blood-brain barrier starts opening up because it's a repetitive condition, and then the blood-brain barrier opens up. When it opens up, the infection may be not present in the brain anymore, or in the spine, or in the central nervous system for that matter. But now you have a dumber immune system systemically that is able to go across into the blood-brain barrier and continue to cause neurological symptoms. And so that, this is going to fall off.
Dr. Morales, can I just really quick make sure I follow you, because I want to make sure we're getting a complete understanding of what you're saying here. I think the two scenarios you're describing are, one, you have a systemic active infection of Borrelia, Lyme disease, whatever else comes along with it, and the blood-brain barrier, those infections cross through, and the infections and the bacteria are in the brain, and therefore you're having neurological symptoms from the infection in the brain, which is option one. But then option two is your immunological response, your immune system response now is going through the blood-brain barrier, and the immune response in the brain is causing inflammation and therefore causing symptoms, but not from the bacteria directly, but from a consequence of the immune response to the bacteria that was there before. Is that what I'm hearing, or am I wrong with that analysis?
Let me reiterate.
Okay.
Option one is systemic infection triggering neurological symptoms because of infection reaching the brain. Yep. And then maybe infection then being eliminated in the brain, and then the damage left is what's causing the neurological symptoms, but no longer the infection. And then let's say option 1.1 is the same example, with the difference that the blood-brain barrier is open and your dumb immune cells are crossing, producing inflammation. So now there is an autoimmune encephalitis as a result of the Lyme, in addition to the systemic Lyme. And then option two, which is where I was going to, the patient that has actually neurological Lyme as a diagnosis. I tend to differentiate them by certain symptoms, but the ultimate differentiation comes from a spinal tap, where you can do a CXCL13 testing, which will produce a positive or negative result and that's the method of diagnosis for neurological Lyme. So if you're uncertain, you do the spinal test, you do the spinal tap. I don't recommend neurologists doing the spinal tap. They usually don't do a really good job. I have found an anesthesiologist who we have an anesthesiologist in house, and that anesthesiologist, he's always getting in the spine for any surgical procedure. So his ability with hands is just great. And I have found that anesthesiologists do a great work at pulling spinal fluid, painless almost. And that also reduces the effects that come after the spinal tap, which is encephalitis and inflammation, and then migraines and all that. Post spinal tap migraines and encephalitis. And so back to the point, you then are able to diagnose neurological Lyme by doing a spinal tap with the, as I said, CLX-CL13 test. That's the only manner. That's the only way that you are able to take apart a Lyme from a neurological Lyme patient. However, I see symptoms that are specific to neurological Lyme that I don't see on the other ones, even if they have Lyme with neurological symptoms. I'll explain. Lyme with neurological symptoms would be joint pain because it's systemic, fatigue because the immune system and every system that is metabolically challenged is affected. And then you have your head pressure and your headaches and your visual disturbances and your light sensitivity and a lot of brain fog and cognitive issues. Okay? That's your systemic Lyme with neurological symptoms. And then there is the notological Lyme, which is unable to use some motor functions, which is having seizures, which is having a dysautonomic response. So the heart, the blood pressure, and the temperature are all over the place. And that is the main difference. There are some other key aspects like depth perception and psychiatric symptoms that will also be part. But then those you can also get with other conditions like Bartonella and with autoimmune encephalitis. So I think that I try to focus on those aspects to determine if I will treat it as a neurological Lyme or as a systemic. And there is differences of treatment. And that's what I'm presenting of my work is what is the mortality rate on all the research being published all over the world on neurological Lyme when you're treated with just antibiotics versus being treated with plasmapheresis versus being treated with stem cells versus being treated with steroids versus being treated with something else. And
right.
Doing that study helped me personally come up with the best choice of treatments that to always use when I'm dealing with a neurological Lyme patient. And that way I have been able to improve the number of cases that are improving. I have been able to increase the number of cases improve with that condition in particular, because it's difficult to treat neurological.
So really you're saying the second option, which is you have neurological Lyme, meaning the infection is in your brain, correct? So I want to make sure I got that right.
Your central nervous system, I cut to the point saying the brain, but in the central nervous system, yes.
Right. And then option one is it could be damage after the fact, and whatever occurred from the neurological Lyme or the Lyme is now damage after the fact, or it's an immune response and an autoimmune encephalitis, right? That's the other bucket you described, correct?
Yes.
Okay, got it. And that's important because treatments will vary depending on which bucket you fall in. And that's why you have to try to identify based on different symptoms that are unique to each group or bucket. And then based on your discussion and your evaluation, you can treat differently depending on where we are. And I know our listeners are going to want to know, what treatments do you use for each categorization in each bucket, right?
Yeah, we could spend an hour talking about treatment. There is a lot of tools in the toolbox, but that's just speaking very superficially. So you can see sometimes how difficult it is to come to a diagnosis. That's not even getting into it that some patients will have neurological Lyme plus PANS plus motor and neuropathy plus mold. And, you know, how do you differentiate what is causing what neurological symptom?
Got it. So it's a much more complex question, but I do want to touch on this because we've heard it's kind of a segue here, but pertaining to the brain, we've heard a lot about brain pathways and brain retraining in the chronic Lyme community, whether it's DNRS, whether it's Gupta, whether it's Vitalside, whether it's Primal Trust. And we've had all these people on the podcast to discuss neuroplasticity. And essentially they're saying that when we get sick from chronic Lyme, our brain pathways change, and brain scans have shown that the sick brain post chronic Lyme has pathways that aren't serving them. They're inflammatory pathways and they're not healthy pathways. And by doing these brain elasticity programs, they can almost reset the brain to healthy pathways that are not inflammatory. Now, do you subscribe to this? And if so, you know, what are your thoughts on tying this part together to everything else you've discussed already?
Yeah, I think it's so complex because now we need to kind of break down pathogens. When we're talking about Bartonella, I see a change in the neurotransmitters and the neurotransmitter interaction with the nodoreceptor, so much so that oftentimes Bartonella patients who are using, let's say, a SSRIs or a benzodiazepine, the way that they respond, that their nodoreceptors will respond to that pharmaceutical will have a paradoxical response sometimes because of the influence of Bartonella in the mechanisms between nodoreceptors and neurotransmitters. So there is a chemistry change that will produce paradoxical effects from the usage of antipsychotics, which is a whole just topic on its own of interest. And that tells us that the involvement of certain pathogens on how cells are communicating within the central nervous system has a deeper effect than originally thought. And so that is just chemically speaking. If you talk about structure, if you get a cut, like I have here on my finger, I have a cut here from when I was a kid. And I was so upset with my mom that time that I didn't even ever told her. So I just wrapped my finger on clots until I was able to stop the bleeding, and I never got a stitch in here. So as a result, that structure changed. And I can always see my cut in that finger. And so when we're having inflammatory reactions in our brain, the scarring tissue also changes the anatomical structures in the brain. As a result of the anatomical changes, you also have chemical changes as a result. And so I believe there is a circumstance where pressure, structure, and chemistry play a role of the development and behavior of that central nervous system, if that makes any sense.
It does. No, it certainly does. And, you know, this kind of ties into why some people tell us that ketamine treatment, for example, is extremely helpful. And maybe I'm wrong with drawing a parallel here, but we've had guests tell us that ketamine has helped them almost just after several ketamine treatments, their anxiety is gone, their depression is gone, and that it has an impact on their brain, right? So is ketamine something you've used in your clinic? And if so, do you think there's a correlation between ketamine and almost calming down the mind and the brain? And, you know, in what ways, if so, because as you noted, there's many different ways, right? The structural, the chemical, et cetera.
So there, I love this question because you're talking about really what I'm saying, which is receptors and how they respond to stimuli. And for instance, patients which I see sometimes, what they mention this word to me, akathisia. If you hear it as a doctor, you should pay attention to what they're using. Akathisia means lack of joy, just lack of stimuli. That like they're not feeling any good or bad feelings. They are completely flat with their feelings. And so why is that? It's because of the neurotransmitters. And in some cases, patients use certain pharmaceuticals that are producing a certain signal to their neuroreceptors, I'm sorry. As a result, when they discontinue those pharmaceuticals, there is a SSRI discontinuation syndrome, for instance. And as a result, the brain and central nervous system tries to reproduce the effects by shooting a lot of neurotransmitters. As a result, that nerve gets damaged because of the overstimuli.
So it tries to compensate for the loss of the SSRI. And when it tries to compensate, it then damages it, right?
Exactly. And so the body is always trying to compensate things. As a result, that leads into something known as excitotoxicity, which is toxicity of the nerve from too much glutamate or too much neurotransmitter of one given time, because it's just trying to mimic what the pharmaceutical was doing, and it destroys the nerve. As a result, there is akathisia, and then there's numbness, and then there's genital numbness, and then there's sexual dysfunction. And then as that is just a broad example of many things that could be going on with patients, that sometimes ketamine can have an effect. So now let's go back to the simpler example with ketamine. You have the same neuroreceptor, and then you have pharmaceuticals or toxins of bacteria that have bind to that neuroreceptor, like Bartonella, and that changes the way that neuroreceptor is. So now things only bind to a piece of it, and it's not able to bind to both. And so you get a strong pharmaceutical, stronger than anything in the past, like ketamine. And ketamine grabs those, and it grabs specifically muscarinic receptor 1 and 2. And as it's doing that, it's resetting the original function of that receptor. So patients who have have that problem with their nodoreceptors, and they then get a MU1, MU2 muscarinic receptor reset button, like that. That's what ketamine does. Then their chemistry is then reestablished. And as a result, then they feel better, not less depression, less anxiety, less neuropathy, less pain. So that's the reason.
So essentially, the cause of some of these things can be either microbial from things like Bartonella, as you described, or potentially even a result of pharmaceutical uses like SSRIs. And in both cases, ketamine can be helpful to reset your brain, essentially, to put it simply, right? And help you have a more normal state that you were born with, almost like a factory reset, if I can think of it that way.
Because it's a stronger binder than any other one there available. Ketamine is a stronger binder.
So I don't want to lose sight of asking you, you do a ton of treatments. I mean, first of all, to Richard's point, everybody should go to your website. Your website blew me away in preparation for this interview, and that's LimeMexico.com, but more specifically, LimeMexico.com/treatments. I mean, I have never seen a website with as many treatment options that are grouped by categories with specific, easy to understand explanations of what they are. So really good. And the reason I'm highlighting this is because most of our listeners are people that are trying to feel better at various stages of chronic Lyme. And this is a really good cheat sheet for us to be able to go on and learn what's out there, possibly, come see you in Mexico at Lyme Mexico. But if people can't afford that simply, then they can at least use this as a resource to try to do things on their own to gain better health, right? And when it comes to all these different things from regenerative therapies, antiviral, I mean, antioxidants, biofilms, hyperthermia, detox. I mean, you even have something really cool on there about, I believe it was hyperthermia and what was it? Hyperthermia and lysophram, correct? That you talk about?
Yeah, I did. So, we did a study on that as well.
Yeah. So can you just tell us, highlight the top three treatments that you use for most of your patients to have success in treating the microbial part of chronic Lyme disease, meaning Lyme and everything else, not just Borrelia burgdorferi, but all the co-infections that we commonly see, including things that are reactivated viruses, like you mentioned, the herpes virus and things like that. Because I believe in most cases, if you're chronically ill from Lyme, it's all of the above, reactivated viruses, co-infections, your body is really depleted from many, many different things, not just Borrelia.
So you mentioned something that caught my attention, which is some patients are not able to afford all the treatments and all, or even all of the doctor's consults. And I see that often. I'm just going to make a parenthesis here. And so since I saw the first case, since then, for 10 years now, I don't charge my first consult. So I will speak to you if you have no money, because it's important for me to understand you. And I think it's a fair trade because I'm able to learn from you as well. I need information to learn. I learn through patients as well. Not everything is just in a book. It's not. A lot of the things that we know, we as doctors, we either know because we talk to other doctors or because we talk to patients and they give us that information. So talk to me and I'll give you if you can't receive treatment, I'll give you an opinion. I will give you guidance so that I'm not just giving out a one-size-fits-all treatment right here to your audience and then they'll try to replicate it and don't have the result they're looking for. I prefer they call us. I'll talk to you. I will make sure to give you the best recommendation, as I've always done. And then we go from there. That way, you get to experience what is it that I'm thinking about your case and to see if I'm worth, the wait or if I'm worth it, your time. And then you can decide whether or not you want to continue in paying your consults. And that way, I also get to be able to ask the questions I need. Because believe it or not, some patients, they have their own agenda and they'll call and they'll say, doctor, I need you to answer these questions. And I'm like, okay, hold on. Do you want me to answer your questions first, or should you answer my questions so that I can then understand you and be able to answer your questions? So I prioritize my questions because that's the way that I do my work and that's the way I can understand patients better. But so top three treatments. Generally speaking, I make emphasis on four areas of treatment: killing infection, persisting forms, detox, and immunological modulation. So three treatments would be one that addresses one of each at least. So to kill active infection, I like a combination. It has to be intravenous. I usually do intravenous antibiotics that are for intracellular infection, for extracellular infection, and for infections that are resistant. I won't go into detail what antibiotics those are because they're separate depending on the infections that I'm dealing with. Maybe I will use one antibiotic that deals with two or three infections at one time because that patient has two or three infections at one time. Those, and I know patients are saying right now, oh, but I hate antibiotics and they're the devil. Sure, in some cases, they're the devil. In some cases, they're a means to an end. I only use antibiotics for short-term courses, by the way. And I use them because there is a factor of momentum. When you're having momentum against these infections, antibiotics work. This is, at the end of the day, still an infectious disease. So let's treat it as such. Some cases, I won't use antibiotics. But anyway, I combine antibiotics with oxidative therapies. That gives me a better effect. So UV light, ozone, hyperbaric ozone, and silver. I use silver like I use soap. I love silver. Silver, actually, my thesis was on silver, and I loved silver. I've done research with silver for far longer than I've been treating Lyme disease. And so there, I work with the university. We have a specific intravenous silver that we know has more effects on active Lyme, so we use that. Anyway, so that's just one treatment. Combining oxidative therapies with intravenous oxidative therapies with intravenous antimicrobials, I like that. Secondly, for the persisting forms, I like to use hyperthermia, and I use a cocktail. Sometimes one that was published by Dr. Ying Sang, who I haven't seen in a while. I think he went back to China, but he used to do a lot of research with Biofilm. I like his research a lot. I like Dr. Sappi's, McDonald, and Kim Lewis's research. But so we make a kind of a combination with all that in our own cocktail, which is intravenous, and we provide that with hyperthermia. The reason we do that is because hyperthermia, we know, kills certain strains of Lyme, not all strains, because this is just what research shows. Some claim that hyperthermia cures all the Lyme strains. That's not accurate. It just helps eliminate some of the strains of Lyme. But what it does very effectively, it increases the efficacy of antibiotics 16-fold. And this is also research, published research that is available, where we see that antibiotics will have 16 times more penetration when incorporating hyperthermia. So that's fantastic. We're able to destroy biofilms that way and persisting forms. That's number two. And then number three, detox. So plasmapheresis, best detox I have. You get rid of heavy metals, toxins, cytokines, mold, just to name a few, 3 liters worth of it. So it's like this much of liquid, which you get discarded in one procedure. And you replace it for synthetic albumin, proteins, amino acids, vitamins, and electrolytes. Simple. We're not using
plasma. Sorry to interrupt, but plasmapheresis, can you describe what that is for our listeners, please?
No, I'm just kidding. Yes.
No, absolutely not. At a very simple level. I know it can be complex, but just at a very simple level, what that looks like.
A video not so long ago. It's not a video. I just recorded it. And where I explain it very thoroughly, there is a video going on, and there's just my voice, and it's in our Instagram. And it shows you how it starts. Basically, it's a procedure where a patient is comfortably sitting down or laying down. There is a machine that is known as a cell separator. That machine is connected to a disposable kit. This disposable kit is then connected to the patient through an IV. It could be a peripheral IV. And then there is two methods, either to one IV and the disposable kit, or through one IV on one side and another IV on the other side, and both go to the disposable equipment. They work the same. There are two types of apheresis, the one that is filtration and the one that is complete exchange. I focus on the one that is complete exchange. We also have filtration. I don't use it that much. Complete exchange has a better outcome with the patients, clear and simple. And so as we're doing the exchange, basically the machine takes out the blood, filters toxins, filters the gunk, separates it into a bag, and it's returning the healthy proteins and healthy plasma and healthy blood back to the patient. And then once the procedure is done, we have 3 liters worth of gunk that has got to be discarded into the garbage. And that's the end of the procedure. It's like changing the oil in a car. Why is it important? Well, because you have consumed environmental toxins, pharmaceuticals, toxics that go into your mouth, things that you haven't been able to eliminate for years. They're floating in your plasma. All of these things that you can't get rid of, they're floating in your plasma. And in addition to that, if you're fighting off chronic infection, you're going to have inflammatory cytokines that are floating in your plasma, which will inhibit proper development of immunological cells. It's like a freeway filled with cars. How do you get through one exit to the next when it's full with traffic? You can't. That's the same deal with cytokines in your bloodstream. So you remove all that, and now your blood flows better. There's better circulation. There's less toxins. You know, Dr. Nabio, he did research. I talked to Stephen Harris about this, on how pharmaceuticals that were used 10 years ago, I'm not explaining this properly. The study he used showed that there were traces of antibiotics from patients that have used antibiotics 10 years prior. Why? Because the elements, the carrier that were carrying the antibiotic stuck to the blood, and the antibiotic did its job. Oh, there. The antibiotic did its job, but then the mechanism that carries the antibiotic, which is a formula, that is left in the blood, and we're not talking about that. And those are toxic things, and spike proteins from COVID, all these things are toxic things that are floating in the blood plasma.
Yeah. So Dr. Morales, I just want to say, first of all, your explanation of plasmapheresis was really well done. But on your website, under the treatment section, there is a section for plasmapheresis, and you have a 42-minute video, which is awesome, about plasmapheresis and red cell exchange treatment. So I highly encourage everybody to go watch that. We are at our time. So I just want to say again, for everybody listening to this podcast, we highly recommend everybody check out your website, LymeMexico.com, just to learn. If people are looking for treatment and they feel stuck in their healing journeys, we highly recommend they reach out to you for a consult and to treat with you, and to explore what that looks like by setting up a session with you. And Dr. Morales, we can't thank you enough for coming on and giving us so much of your time and teaching us so much on our Tick Bootcamp podcast.
Thank you very much, guys, for what you're doing. It was awesome, and it was a really great experience. You both had very interesting points, and I appreciated each of you guys.